This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 22nd, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 401. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the big deal feature, the Vancouver Anti-Corruption Institute hosted the 2025 Conference on Asset Forfeiture. Top legal experts from Canada, the US, UK, and Ireland discussed the ways and means of taking away the ill-gotten gains from criminals. Kim Campbell, Canada's 19th Prime Minister, was the conference chair. On this edition of the podcast, hear Kim Campbell deliver the closing speech. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. The Vancouver Anti-Corruption Institute hosted the 2025 Conference on Asset Forfeiture on June 17th and 18th in Vancouver. Asset forfeiture is the process for authorities to ask the courts to take away real estate, cars, boats, crypto, and cash from criminals. The conference was organized by Peter German, the former head of the RCMP in Western Canada and an expert on money laundering. The conference chair was the former Progressive Conservative Member of Parliament for Vancouver Centre, who is better known for occupying higher offices. Kim Campbell was Canada's first female Attorney General and first female Defence Minister, before she became Canada's first and, so far only, female Prime Minister in 1993. The first British Columbia-born Prime Minister cut her teeth as a Vancouver School Board Chair and MLA for Vancouver Point Grey. She now calls Italy home. Here is Kim Campbell's closing speech at the 2025 Conference on Asset Forfeiture.
This has been an extraordinary couple of days, and I wanted just to make a couple of comments. First of all, my Minister of Justice antenna have been quivering throughout this conversation, because in all of the conversations about what's not working and the challenges of communication, it sort of stimulated my natural instinct, which is to try and solve a problem and to bring people together. And when I was, my short happy career as Prime Minister, I actually restructured the ministries of the Canadian government. I created the Department of Public Safety. And in 1995, evidently, there was a report published about that reorganization that was never made public until this year. I guess the 30-year secrecy expired. And I discovered that this thing had been published and that it was very complimentary about my reorganization, which is probably now still hopefully out of date. But the point is that I think one of the things that governments need to do is to come together and have an ongoing, constant process of evaluation about how things are working and how communication can be improved. And that involves the kinds of, I think there are some bodies that exist that bring together people in the forfeiture area. But there needs to be a constant narrative about why it's important and what it means and what is required. We need to be looking at what are the modern techniques, artificial intelligence, which you know I'm worried about, but are there mechanisms that we can create that would allow the players in this system, the law enforcement officers, to feed in the information that would make better use of the forfeiture instruments that are at their disposal. So we need to think in really modern 21st century terms. As Kevin Brosseau pointed out, this Bill C-2, he never expected to see such a piece of legislation so early in a government's mandate. And he was very optimistic about what that would mean. I think we are at an inflection point in Canada, where as a result of our fear of Donald Trump's threats to our sovereignty, and let's face it, that's what it is, we realize that we need to break down barriers between the provinces and find ways to cooperate together. And so I think we need to, and I'm actually, you know, I actually met the new Minister of Justice at the opening of Parliament, and, you know, I could actually give him a call and say, you know, you ought to convene a task force on this, because this is really important, and that's for the federal Minister of Justice, that's, an, I think, an important role, to be a convener. In my life, my whole approach in politics at all three levels of government was always to convene people. When Anne McClellan became the second woman to be Minister of Justice, she was asked by the officials if she wanted to follow the Campbell mode of consultation. where I was evidently known for consulting much more broadly than was with the usual suspects in developing laws. And I've never found that that's let me down. I've always found that you can learn a great deal. But getting the players around the table, and that's what we saw with the Irish example, when they're all around the table and they're all sharing their perspectives and what they know, that's how you get the answers. And then again, the legislators and policymakers need to follow this up in order to give you the instruments that you need. Now, having said that, however, I want to remind you that the concerns about privacy are not foolish, because the United States has just given us an object lesson about what it means to have your country's data stolen. DOGE wasn't about government efficiency. DOGE was an opportunity to allow Elon Musk to bring in his little techies to download the data of all of the departments of the United States government, which has now then been passed on to Palantir, which is led by a man who does not believe in democracy, who believes that the country should be run by a CEO and a government of technocrats. He doesn't believe that women and people of color should have the vote because they're too liberal. One of the things he advocates is the elimination or what's the word I'm looking for, of the 19th Amendment, which provides votes for women. And if you think I'm being, people who know me, I am the least conspiratorial minded person, but you know, I can't pretend I don't know what I know. I'm also a former Soviet specialist, which is why I look at Vladimir Putin and I know exactly what I'm looking at. But this is happening in the United States. These are people who also want to create a constitutional convention to get rid of the current American Constitution. It takes 34 states to agree to that. 26 have signed up. If that doesn't make your blood run cold, I don't know what does. So when we're talking about the protection of privacy, we need to realize that this is a complex and very sensitive issue. As Canadians, we have an opportunity to deal with it in ways, and that's why if we're all together and we talk about what would happen if we did this, what would happen if we did that, if we shared this kind of information, what are the guardrails we've put in place and why have we done that? Because we want to avoid a situation where a bunch of little 20-year-olds come in with their hard drives and download all the data from the International Revenue, the IRS, Social Security, all of the databases of the American government. I don't know where they are now. Are they in Moscow? Probably. I mean, quite seriously, we need to understand that our privacy and our respect for privacy is not some kind of left-wing woke fantasy. It has to do with the protection of Canadians, our ability to have some control in an era where we have very little control, you know, where Google is watching us, where everything we do on our phones. I mean, we're all, I think, pretty naive about how much privacy we have. But at the very least, our governments should not be complicit in undermining our capacity to have some kind of private life and identity. I think we can deal with this. But I think, you know, when Evelyn was talking about politically motivated prosecutions, that's what you're looking at. And imagine, I mean, for my American friends, I mean, I want to clasp you all to my bosom and protect you, because you're going back to a country where your capacity to be private, to do things according to your conscience, to support the political parties and the forces and causes that are important to you. And I have friends who are senior lawyers in the United States who are working on legislation pushing back against the Trump agenda. But you're also vulnerable now because you don't know who's got all your records. You know, because the President of the United States allowed somebody to go in and basically steal all that data. So what I want to say to you is that we need to be smart, we need to be sophisticated, and we need to protect us. I think we can achieve these goals. I think we can use forfeiture. And the reason why forfeiture is so important, if you'll notice that both in Ireland and with our own wonderful fentanyl czar talking about his role, really it's the drug trade that is really fueling so much of organized crime. And the numbers, the orders of magnitude are just kind of unimaginable. I remember once years ago reading a book about Ivan Bosky and Michael Milken and the, you know, all the scandals they got into. And I remember reading these stories and, you know, I'd never seen so many zeros after a number. I mean, people had like $400 million. I mean, that just seemed like so much because I was, you know, when I was young, if somebody had $1 million, that was a lot. Now we're looking at zeros and zeros and zeros, quantities of money. You know, was it El Chapo's $60 million a month? I mean, of course, the temptation to do this is huge. But what I think was is so important is that there are two audiences for forfeiture. One is the criminals themselves in the hopes that the certainty of it, and if we can make the system more effective and empower those who implement it. One of our speakers said that the policies are only good as the agencies that implement them. So if we empower the agencies to do them well, to do them in a coordinated way, if we take the burden off our police officers of a lot of paperwork, if we find ways of simplifying and speeding up the reporting of things to get things in a system, but also in a way that respects the need for the officers to be able to take personal responsibility for the information they're doing, we can do all of that. If we do that, and if we make forfeiture more and more certain, perhaps that will help, perhaps be a deterrent, or at least certainly help us in our enforcement of the law. But also, as Barry Butler said, and as Kevin said, it's the public also, that one of the things about asset forfeiture is it puts accountability in the window. When the you know, ill-gotten gains, the proceeds of crime, you know, Kevin said, Canadians are fed up. People, or the comment about that Americans, as Bill Browder said, that Americans don't like things that are unfair. The notion that people are getting away with these enormous thefts, these enormous ripoffs at the expense of the pain of our citizens, that if they can see that these ill-gotten gains are being drawn back, that they are being put back either to serve public services or to go back into the government exchequer to fund the cost of law enforcement. It's a very important piece of the puzzle of the credibility of democratic governance. And much of my life, since I had political retirement thrust upon me by the Canadian electorate, has been in the world trying to create, you know, to promote the importance of democratic governance. In order to provide the possibility for people to have their rights protected and to fulfill themselves in societies where they can live freely. So I think it's really important to recognize what this means. And you are all part of something very important in terms of the broader health of your democratic society. But there's also such an important human dimension. And let me just tell you a little story. Some of you know I live in Italy. And one of the women who works in our house in Italy, a wonderful woman, she's actually a certified horticulturalist, and we have the greatest vegetable garden you've ever seen. Anyway, but this last year, her daughter, who was in her last year of high school, came and did a student exchange here in Burnaby. In fact, she just went home this week. And her mother came in the spring into Vancouver and visited and was absolutely thrilled to be here. But when her daughter first came here, and she was doing something, I think it wasn't at Simon Fraser University, but it was some program, I think, run out of Simon Fraser's. It was in Burnaby. But her daughter expressed to her mother her astonishment at the number of the young people that she interacted with who were constantly high on fentanyl. And when Elena said that to me, my blood went red cold for two reasons. First of all, because I'm thinking, my God, she must be terrified that her own daughter might get caught up in this, and I don't think she did. I think Emma has gone home and has had a wonderful time here. But it also made me realize how detached I am from that reality. I'm not living in a life at the moment with teenage kids around. And I know about the fentanyl problem, but I don't see it right in front of me. And similarly, when Barry Butler was talking about cocaine addiction in the small communities of Ireland, and how it's tearing those communities apart and how much it means to them to see these traffickers being brought to account. But the human cost of this is so enormous. 21 Canadians die every day from fentanyl. So all of this is part of a big picture where the future of our society depends on how we handle it. And what was so wonderful about the last 2 days was how warming it was to see the array of competence and experience and dedication and interest in sharing, just everything that you would want to have in a community to solve a problem. Bill Browder has been my hero all my life, and I was thinking how nice it was that he was knighted. I've always thought that that's a lovely title, Sir Somebody Rather, because you use your first name. It's not Lord Somebody with your name, but Sir William. There's always, it's sort of, and I think of Chaucer's, perfect gentle knight, although he was also satirizing knighthood. But then I also think of Bill Browder, who started out as a billionaire hedge funder, and I think of Shakespeare's comment that some are born great, some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them. And Bill Browder had greatness thrust upon him when he accepted the challenge of trying to vindicate the death of his wonderful young lawyer who was only trying to make Russian society better. So there are good people in this world who are trying to make things better. And some people ask me, what I'm doing now. I say, I'm trying to be a good ancestor. I'm trying to do whatever I can to think about the future. And I say to all of you who work in this field, you're not all lawyers. I think, Phil Taudry, you're not a lawyer, but many of you are lawyers. And earlier this month, I was honored by the Canadian Bar Association. And I said there, because people were very, very worried, as I think I said in my opening remarks, that the constant theme of the whole evening was how worried people are about what's happening in the United States and the assault on the rule of law. But what I said then is that all of us who have had the privilege to study the law, however we use it, because there are many different ways that you can use your legal training, but I think we have a professional, a moral, and a civic responsibility to be guardians of the law, to understand what it means. It's very precious. In Italy, I have visited Canadian war graves. I mean, all that we have has been paid for over the decades in many different conflicts and different circumstances by others. And we have a very important obligation, I think, to be the guardians of law, the law. And when I said to my husband, I was talking to him, he was in Italy, and he said, "Now, what are you doing?" I said, "I'm at a conference on asset forfeiture." And he's a concert pianist, playwright, and actor. You'll understand that asset forfeiture doesn't ring many bells with him. And he looked rather puzzled, and I said, "I'll explain it to you when I get home." And, it may sound like kind of an esoteric term, but what you've made very clear over the last 2 days is that it's a key piece of the puzzle. And if we do it right, it does give us a tool against a very insidious, worrisome, powerful criminal force in our society, because we get them where it hurts. We get them in the pocketbook, and it is all about the money. So thank you all, safe travels to all of you. And I hope that this is the beginning of more conversations, and I promise anybody that I meet in the government who has anything to do with anything, I will tell them that they need to start thinking about processes to make it work better, to coordinate, to evaluate what can be changed and what things need to still be protected. So, safe travels. Thank you for everything. You've honored me by asking me to be your chair. And incidentally, Peter German is a national treasure. I just say, hey, Peter. We are now adjourned. Thank you.
That was Kim Campbell, Canada's 19th Prime Minister, with the closing speech of the 2025 Conference on Asset Forfeiture in Vancouver on June 18th. More information on the Vancouver Anti-Corruption Institute. Go to icclr.com/VACI.
Breaker.news podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Taiwan news, Taiwan presale housing transactions plunged 70% in April. Real estate experts said presale housing market in freefall. Taipei's daily transaction average dropped from 26 units per day in April 2024 to just 7.5 this year. Cheng Chengder, a research manager at Shinny Realty, said that after a series of regulatory tightening measures by the central bank last year, buyer sentiment has become more cautious. In ABC News Australia, winter solstice brings widespread frost as Australia's coldest towns revealed. based on overnight temperatures in the depths of winter, Australia's coldest town is Cooma in southern New South Wales. During July, the town, which is known as the capital of the Snowy Mountains, it averages minus 2.6 degrees Celsius at night and minus 2 Celsius at the airport. What about during the day? Well, in July, Oberon, in the central Tablelands, peaks at between 8.1 Celsius and 8.8 Celsius. Australia's coldest ever temperature was minus 23 Celsius, recorded on June 29, 1994 at Charlotte Pass. In Kyoto news, Japan destroyer sails Taiwan Strait after China jet encounter. It was the third known passage through the waterway by a Japanese Navy ship, with all occurring within the past year, aimed at warning China, which continues to pressure Taiwan. The latest transit came after Japan's defense ministry said that a Chinese J-15 fighter jet from the aircraft carrier Shandong came as close as 45 meters to Japanese P-3C surveillance plane on June 7th and 8th. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, Portland's WNBA owners had one job. Don't name the team after the disaster destroying our state, says columnist Bill Oram. A record 1.8 million acres of Oregon burned last year, and state agencies have expressed concern that they will not have enough firefighters to battle whatever awaits them in this remarkably dry year. While Portland's franchise, which starts play next summer, has not made anything official, eagle-eyed local reporter Sean Hyken caught this week that the WNBA had filed trademark applications for the fire, indicating plans to resurrect the name of the team that last played in the city in 2002. In crosscut, Washington spent $45 million to boost electric vehicle use with mixed results. The state offered rebates to lower-income residents to help buy or lease an EV, but Cascade PBS found the program struggled to reach those communities. Qualifying drivers could receive $9,000 to lease a new EV for 3 years, $5,000 to buy a new EV, or $2,500 to buy or lease a used EV, the largest amounts of any rebate program in the country. Contractor Energy Solutions capped the market value of eligible EVs at $90,000. The vast majority, more than 4,000, opted for 3-year leases. Only 23% of rebate dollars went to so-called overburdened communities. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. Goodbye, Patello Bridge. Hello, to-be-announced Musqueam and Kwantlen name. And Carney's housing minister has investments in at least 3 BC properties. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com.
That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Beach Lifeguards. It's summertime again, so a shout out to the brave people in the high chairs, looking out for the safety of swimmers and paddlers. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob at thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 22nd, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 22nd of June in 2007, an F5 tornado, the most powerful recorded in Canadian history, hit Ely, Manitoba? It was a miracle that nobody got hurt. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow the Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support the Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.